in their heifer program, there's some, you know, puberty, 9 to 11 months. We want to breed. The optimal age is 12 to 15. Usually we're shooting for a body weight around 750 to 850 pounds at the time of breeding. And then looking at, you know, wither height and heart girth, that those are also considering that skeletal development. We want them to reach around 90% of their skeletal development, because then that's, you know, allowing them to shift their energy towards that.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Adiseo USA, producers of SmartAmine M and MilkPay.com. Hi-D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status to deliver higher milk yield and carcass efficiency. Asepsis, an ounce of prevention. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Volac, unlocking ruminant potential through nutritional solutions for a sustainable future. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together.
Welcome back to the Dairy Podcast Show. My name is Barry Bradford from Michigan State University. Today, I'm happy to have as a guest Dr. Jennifer Spencer. Jennifer is an assistant professor and an extension research dairy specialist with Texas A&M AgriLife, based in Stephenville, Texas. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
You're working in Texas now. Are you a native Texan?
No, I'm native to Idaho. I grew up in Boise, Idaho.
So tell me a little bit about your path that got you here to A&M.
So I went to University of Idaho actually for my bachelor's, master's, and PhD. So they call that like line breeding, right?
Okay.
All your degrees from one university. But my focus area was dairy cattle reproductive physiology under Dr. Amin Amazada. But we did more of the, you know, management things that could be easily implemented onto a dairy.
Did you get into that path because you grew up in agriculture and you were interested in that, or was it more of a just animal science interest?
That's a really good question. So I always grew up wanting to be a vet, but growing up in the city, it was a little bit hard, but my mom got me into FFA and 4-H. So I raised sheep, paid for my college. So that was nice. But I went to school wanting to do that and I wanted to focus on sheep. And then I took a dairy science class and fell in love with it. So decided to go that route.
So you actually lived in Boise proper, but somehow you found a way to raise some sheep. How did that work out?
I know, right? It's a little bit difficult. We had to drive a little bit to get to some, you know, land. There were farmers that they were really very helpful. They would let me just lease the land for free, and I just had to maintain some of the pasture.
Well done. Learned some entrepreneurship too, huh?
Right, yeah.
That's good. And so how long have you been at A&M now?
So I came to A&M in 2018, so August of 2018. I think I'm now going on to the sixth year.
Okay.
So been quite a while. And Ellen Jordan, actually, she's the one that told me to apply for the position during an ADSA conference. So it's kind of nice to have a job when you get out of college.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, congratulations. So we're going to talk about some of your research here, but before we dive into that, can you give me a feel for what you do like holistically in your role? I know a lot of what you do is extension as well.
Yeah, so I have a 75% extension and 25% research appointment.
Okay.
But most of my focus is on extension, and I do a lot of programs for counties, and we do employee training. We do youth programs, so trying to get youth, high school age students interested in dairy before they go to college, so they kind of have an idea what dairy does, what the opportunities are, career opportunities. And then I do a lot of manure management and nutrient management. That was kind of a new area. I had to learn a lot about it, but we do it for producers for their nutrient management plans.
That's the same end of the cow you're used to working on, right?
Right, yeah.
Us nutritionists can never, you know, get past that joke.
Adiseo, a global leader in nutritional solutions and the provider of SmartAmine M.
the best in-class rumen-protected methionine product for dairy producers who want to optimize milk production, capture more value from their components, and maintain the lifetime performance of their herds. For more product information and to calculate your return on investment when you balance your feed with amino acids, go to milkpay.com.
All right. Well, today we're going to talk a little bit about reproductive programs and heifers, which I think, you know, a lot of dairy producers are used to talking about trying to improve reproduction in the lactating cows and maybe think about, well, heifers, that's the easy side of reproduction. Tell me why it's worth focusing on them a little bit too.
Yeah. So we know a lot about dairy cows, lactating dairy cows and their reproductive performance, but heifers have kind of been by the wayside. So right now I think there's a lot more research that's being done on dairy heifer reproduction, which is really neat. My major professor always said, like, tell me a story, right? Start from the beginning. So when we're thinking about it, well, we got to start at the beginning because we know, you know, first lactations, their repro performance does influence their future. So, you know, heifer reproductive performance is going to be the first step into all of that.
Yeah, for sure. And I think one thing that's been very much top of mind in the last 2 years or so is how tight heifer inventories are, right? So if farms are only keeping back 5% extra heifers, it puts a lot more pressure on every step in that process, right? Making sure heifers stay healthy, that they get pregnant and everything so they stay in the pipeline.
Yeah, definitely. And some previous research has said, you know, 75% of them make it into the lactating herd. So when, you know, we start using more beef semen, we are using the sex semen in the industry, but, you know, you want to make sure that you have those replacement heifers. And if that's going to change 70%, 74% is not very much making it from the beginning into the lactating herd.
Absolutely. Do you know, have you seen data on the spread across herds? And I'm sure there's herds that graduate 90% of heifers. Do you have a sense of where the sort of the upper third of herds are at today? Because I don't.
That's a really good question. I'm not sure, but there is quite a variability between herds. I mean, you get to these larger ones and they may not have even, you know, 70%, but smaller herds, it may be easier to manage some of those challenges. You know, maybe they have more replacement heifers because they do have such a small herd that to maintain. But it just kind of, I guess, depends. And really, since it's influenced by so many different things, I think that probably the top one third would probably be in the 80s, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk through then like best practices or, you know, research insights on, you know, how to achieve optimal reproductive efficiency in heifers. So I guess the first thing is like, when are we going to start considering them to be a breeding age? When are they eligible? What do you think about that?
They hit puberty around 9 to 11 months. And once they hit puberty, research says that they need to cycle 3 times in order to maximize their fertility and conceive. But the breeding eligibility age benchmark that most people use is between 12 and 15 months. So if we're thinking about a heifer coming in to puberty at 11 months, well, she probably would need to get bred around 15 months to achieve those 3. So when we're looking at specifically age, you have to take into consideration the puberty time. And maybe to save on resources, it would be better to breed them closer to 15 months versus 11 months. But they do a lot besides age. A lot of the producers I talk to, they just go based on age. But whether, you know, that's the best benchmark to use, it kind of depends, probably depends on the herd and the size of the herd. But other measurements they've been using are body weight. They've done that since, I think, the 1960s was the first research on that. And they verified it, you know, throughout the years. And it is a good predictor because we know that they have to achieve a certain body weight in order to conceive, kind of shifting those nutrients from growth into reproduction. But it's not a perfect, you know, variable to look at. It can differ. Body weight can be high in a short heifer and then she's considered fat, right? So there are other indirect measurements of body weight that I think kind of help with the skeletal, you know, aspect of using body weight as a measurement. We use wither height and heart girth, and those are, you know, indirect measurements of body weight. But even body weight and these measurements, I'm not sure if they're the best predictors in what we could be using to determine heifer eligibility for breeding. In my mind, it kind of depends on their body condition. So we use body condition a lot in lactating cows, but if we're able to use that in heifers, you know, that's more universal. Smaller operations aren't going to have scales to measure body weight. Heart girth and wither height, those are, you know, stressful. You got to touch the animal and they're kind of laborious, right? You got to do each one. So if there's a way that we could visualize these, and some producers I talk to, they say, yeah, we look, you know, at the heifers as they go in. And if they look scraggly, is what they've told me, then they hold them back, you know. Yeah. But I think they've kind of already been doing body condition scores. But then that begs the question, what is the best body condition score for them to have in order to be eligible to be bred?
Yeah, and I assume in heifers, people use the same 0 to 5 scale or 1 to 5 scale that we typically use in lactating cows.
Yeah, so they've been using the 1 to 5 scale with the 0.25 unit increments. Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe that scale isn't appropriate. Maybe we could be looking at beef scales that would help because they are growing. And there's been, you know, quite a bit of research in the beef industry or beef side of things. It may be something to investigate looking at, you know, different scales. But right now they're using the 1 to 5. And, you know, there's no definitive research saying this body condition score is best for them to be eligible to conceive within, you know, 1 or 2 services. They do suggest 3, around 3 body condition score. But in lactating dairy cows, you know, greater than 3.5, they actually, you know, conceive sooner, but you can receive or you can get optimal pregnancies if it's around, you know, 2.75. So, you know, what is that to a dairy heifer? And in our research, we used 2 herds and we found that, you know, it's a huge variability. There was one herd that, you know, was mostly in the 3s, and then there was the other one that we were even scoring them 4.5. So huge variability in the farms.
And did that give you some insights that kind of helped solidify some of the recommendations on body condition for heifers?
Yeah, it really did. You know, because what we found was one herd was around 3.5 at the time of breeding.
Okay.
And the other one was around 3.8. So it was on average about 3.75. And these herds were pretty good at getting their heifers pregnant. They have good conception rates. But, you know, is that 4.5 going to influence their first lactation? Probably.
Right.
Probably depends more on, you know, body condition score before calving and after calving, but still is going to have an influence on, you know, their development and condition.
When you mentioned that fertility is greatest in heifers if they've cycled 3 times, you know, before they're bred. You know, that brings to mind something that's been discussed a lot. It feels like this last year is sort of moving precision technologies into the calf rearing program. And you know, that raises a question. I don't even know if these studies have been done, but if somebody were to implement activity meters to actually track and say, we're not actually going to breed heifers till they hit their 4th heat, you know, do you think that would be an effective management tool if people invested in those tools?
Definitely. And that's something that I've thought before, because you know, some of them put in the ear tags when they're calves and it helps with, you know, disease detection, but
yep.
I don't think we're using that precision technology as much as we could be in heifers. And it would definitely benefit if, you know, you could detect those, you could find those that are reaching puberty at 9 months, and then you could find those that are at 11 months and should wait until they're, you know, 15 months to reduce semen costs, vet costs, everything.
How do you see people approaching, you know, breeding heifers most commonly today? Like, we have those tools, the heat detection tools that people can use. We have classical heat detection. We can synchronize heifers. What are people doing the most of right now?
So a lot of people there that I talk to, they're just using age. Now, some of these larger operations, they'll invest into a body weight scale, but they're expensive. Sometimes they're hard to maintain. So a lot of these other producers, they don't want to invest into that. Plus, you've got to have, you know, the labor to run them across. So besides those two, I don't really hear of people doing those indirect measurements of wither height or heart girth.
Right.
Some of them do use synchronization, and there's, you know, protocols that Dairy Cattle Reproduction Council puts out of the different synchronization protocols. But most producers, they use just prostaglandin and then heat detect and then do another prostaglandin. Okay. So, you know, some of them will do kind of like a pre-sync. So prostaglandin, and then 14 days later, prostaglandin, and they're heat detecting some. I mean, I think there's only a couple that I've even heard of doing cedars. But those, you know, are expensive, and it does tighten heat detection, but what is the cost versus benefit of those? I think it really depends. And some of these synchronization protocols, we have to be careful because we don't want to use them as a Band-Aid. If there's another underlying issue, then maybe we could use something else. And with precision technology, honestly, synchronization protocols, they may help, but if we can use those precision technologies, we can reduce, you know, the amount that we need to actually synchronize. There's some research, I think, by University of Wisconsin, maybe. It's done a little bit on that, activity monitors. I think it's Dr. Fricke. It's going to be upset if I don't remember this, but I'm pretty sure it's Dr. Fricke.
Sounds good. Well, it correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the challenges with any estrus detection strategy, whether you're using technology or humans or what, in lactating cows is that the modern dairy cow has a very short estrus behavior window. And I'm not sure that's as true in heifers. Am I correct that they show estrus for a longer window of time than lactating cows?
A little bit longer, but they also have, you know, three waves that we can kind of influence. So, you know, if we give prostaglandin, we don't have to wait as long to give another prostaglandin to have them come into heat. But typically, there's some research showing that they do have a little bit longer duration of estrus than cows. But that may also be influenced by them producing lactating cows, producing milk. So they're
right, of course,
you know, they've shown that hormones, you know, are reduced in the blood if they're high producing cows. So that too, I mean, we know it does influence, you know, heifers that if they're not gaining enough body weight and at a good body weight, then they're not going to do well.
Yeah. So I think, but part of my point is there's maybe some biological reasons where it may make sense for a given farm maybe to rely heavily on estrus synchronization programs in the lactating herd, but may be able to go to more of a passive detection system in heifers just because of the biological differences. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a great way to kind of summarize this because, you know, they aren't shifting. They're just growth and maintenance, you know, requirements, not the lactation. And then also, it depends on where these heifers are kind of housed. Is it, you know, going to be easy for a producer to lock them up every day? Are they out like on a dry lot? Do you have to push them? Right. Or are they already in a free stall? So I think a lot of that too is going to depend on the facilities, but I think synchronization protocols are definitely more applicable for those dairy cows than they are for dairy heifers.
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Feed solutions that surpass expectations. Learn more about the benefits of working with Schooler. Visit schooler.com/feed. That's schooler.com/feed. Our Yeast 40, ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Diamond V, because animal health deserves a healthier approach. Your partner for extra animal performance, Bergen Schmidt Animal Nutrition. Trow Nutrition, North America. Everything we do is driven by passion and backed by science. Our Yeast 40 is a natural biotechnology from ICC, designed to boost the health and productivity of animals under challenging production systems. Our Yeast 40 performance is supported by an unique processing technology that results in a pure product containing high levels of beta-glucans, MOS, and yeast metabolites. These factors, combined, promote the ruminal and intestinal modulation, helping the animals to reach their full potential.
If people are rethinking their heifer reproduction programs through this discussion, help us with some benchmarks or numbers they should be targeting for conception rates, pregnancy rates, that sort of thing in their heifer program.
Yeah. So in their heifer program, there's some, puberty, 9 to 11 months. We want to breed. The optimal age is 12 to 15. And then usually we're shooting for a body weight around 750 to 850 pounds at the time of breeding. And then looking at, wither height and heart girth, that those are also considering that skeletal development. We want them to reach around 90% of their skeletal development, because then that's, allowing them to shift their energy towards that. But, those are kind of what we've used. But if we think about a dairy operation and that height, the wither height and the heart girth, those are more hands-on. Could we do something to measure that skeletal development behind the cow or behind the heifer? So possibly instead of using those skeletal development parameters, we could use things like hip. And they have done some research on pelvic, with as it relates, to dystocia, but hip height and hip width, they've done a little bit of research in that, but not a whole lot. And seeing if that could be a predictor of, are they eligible to be bred? Are they going to require fewer services? So a lot of these benchmarks, they are, set, and they do reduce the number of times that they have to be serviced and increase the conception rate. But a lot of these times, these measurements are just an average overall. I think there's such a variability within an individual that when we create those numbers that are set, it's a little bit harder to, blanket it over every operation. But keeping in mind that there are those basic fundamentals, we got to look at skeletal development and we have to look at their growth through body weight, body condition. And body condition, they do suggest heifers be around 3 at that time of breeding. But, is that going to reduce services per conception? Is it going to maximize, or do we need them to be 3.5? So that's relatively unknown. I think there's a lot of things that we could look out with heifer breeding eligibility, but even more with puberty and that attainment. I think you made a really good point. Precision technology, could we figure that out? Also, I mean, some of these benchmarks, they were made such a long time ago that the genetic advancements, do they still represent the population? I mean, they did in 2020 verify, you know, body weight does influence reproduction and requiring less, but, you know, hip dimensions, maybe they could be used. So those are kind of two things my lab has been focusing on, that there's not a whole lot of research on, or I guess benchmarks that they've verified are the body condition and the hip dimensions. But any way that we can get these parameters to where management wise, they can cover a lot of different operations, I think that's going to be the best way to go. In the future, people aren't going to invest into these scales. They're just going to go based on age. But in my mind, that's not the best predictor of, you know, determining when they're cycling, when they're able to actually carry a calf.
I want to ask you about one other thing before we run out of time here. So I saw that you helped edit a book called The Cow, A Natural and Cultural History. That sounded interesting. So tell me a little bit about that book project and what the book's all about.
Yeah, so it was kind of like a textbook, almost an educational basic information. So I went through it, made some edits on just the basics, you know, the parts of the stomach, the different breeds, where they came from, what they're known for. So like Jerseys being known for higher fat and protein. Okay. Yeah. But it went down to even like, you know, the composition of a foot or their hoof and what the parts were. And then they would talk a little bit about, you know, how nutrition influences certain things. So it was quite an interesting experience. That's for sure.
I'm wondering about the cultural history part of that. And this is meant for like college courses?
Just kind of in general. It was out of the UK.
Okay.
I think just a kind of basic what the cow is and the history of it all.
Interesting. Okay. I'll have to check that one out sometime. All right. Well, speaking of books, we've got our three famous questions that we have to throw at everybody. So first of all, what's your favorite dairy-related book or resource?
So since I'm a reproductive physiologist, it's got to be about reproduction, but it's Pathways to Pregnancy and Partrition by Dr. Singer. It, by far, I consider it the reproduction Bible, and yep. He simplifies everything down to, you know, graduation is spermatozoa going through, you know, spermiogenesis. I think he just does a really great job with the book.
Incredible science communicator. Yeah.
Yes.
All right. What about your favorite book or resource outside of agriculture?
I went to my favorite book being Where the Red Fern Grows. I mean, I do like the Merck Manual. I know that's probably weird, but that also I consider kind of my dictionary to go to.
Okay.
So I really enjoy the Merck Manual.
So Where the Red Fern Grows, are you a proponent or not of the movie adaptation?
I wasn't because they missed so much information. I feel like that always happens when they turn a book into a movie.
Yeah.
They always, you know, kind of leave a few things out that are important. But I just remember reading it with my brother and my mom. And it's such a sad story, you know, about the dogs. And so I think just the experience, too, that probably made me fall in love. Plus, I always loved dogs. So,
yep. All right. Last question then. In your opinion, what sets successful dairy professionals apart from those who are less successful?
I think what makes, you know, professionals, dairy professionals very successful is continue learning, but also understanding what your limitations are. I'm not a nutritionist by any means. So whenever I have, you know, a question, I'm not afraid to reach out to those colleagues. It's better I mean, dealing with producers and extension, it's better to tell them, hey, I don't know, I'll get back to you, versus, well, it may be this and maybe that. But I think a lot of the dairy professionals, that they are out there to help the dairy producers, and not just be, you know, famous. Those are really the ones that set things apart, you know, make them way more successful in my mind. They remain humble, but they know the overall goal is to help the dairy producers.
Well said. Okay, well, Dr. Jennifer Spencer, thank you very much for joining us on the Dairy Podcast Show.
Yes, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Enjoyed the conversation. So again, this has been the Dairy Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. If you haven't followed the show or liked it yet, make sure you click on that button so you don't miss the next episode. And again, this is Barry Bradford. Thanks for joining, and we'll talk to you next time.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.